The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Saulnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show, Q&A edition, where we're going to do our best today to answer at least a handful, if not more, of questions that have been sent in to us via email, for the most part. My name is Chris Stein. I'm here with Jim Saulnier, and we appreciate everybody listening. If you want to send in your own questions, the best way to do that is go to our website, jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. On there, you'll find a contact form. You can submit it write to us that way. That is the most efficient way. You can also learn a bit, little bit more about us on that website as well, if you're interested. So, welcome to it. Well, you need to turn on your microphone, but after that, we'll have a nice conversation, Jim.
God, how long have I been doing this?
I don't know. We need to have like a professionally produced show.
That would be nice.
We have the professional behind the glass
with the red lights,
and they just, you know, they see you're about to talk, and they dial you up so your microphone comes on automatically. Doing it yourself stuff is for the birds.
We should have something like that. I would agree
someday.
What I wanted to say is you can also just send us an email to Jim@.
I don't like that one though.
Jim Helps.
Then I don't get a copy of it.
Well, sometimes it goes into my junk. I think we finally, hopefully, got it fixed. Who knows? Nice. But we're having a lot go into the junk folder. I don't know why. Staff now is supposed to be looking at said junk folder and printing out the emails for us as well. Okay, well, my goal is to have 8 email questions answered on this show.
What?
Well, I know it's going to be difficult, but we're going to try.
Okay.
I'm going to jump 2 brandy new ones to the top of this massive pile. I don't even count anymore. I gave up with like 60, 70, so we're quite behind. But I'm jumping these up because they're more apropos for what's going on right now. You haven't noticed?
I don't know. It's Thursday.
All my major sporting events not happening. Mm. One of them is more apropos with what is happening in the markets in the world right now, but the other one has to do with taxes. So I want to jump the tax one up because I think this guy's trying to do his taxes and he's got a little bit of confusion. It sounds to me as I read his email that he might have tried to do our 60-day rollover conversion strategy.
It sounds like he's trying to avoid penalties for not paying estimated taxes too.
Is that how you interpreted it?
That's exactly, because that's why he calls it 1040 ES.
Then why is he worried about getting in trouble?
Well, he's just making sure that he can do those steps.
All right. Well, let me read his email and we'll explain all this. We'll do the tax one first. Okay. And I jumped this one to the top of the list, and I'm not having Bob answer it because, number one, Bob's not in today. And number two, I think I know the answer to this.
Okay.
So that's why we're jumping it. And he says, where is he from? Does he give us? No, he does not. I like when they tell us where they're from.
It's fun.
But anyways, he gives us his name, but we're not going to call him his name. We're going to call him, we're going to protect his anonymity.
Or privacy.
I can get it.
Okay.
Anonymity. Mm-hmm. We're going to protect his anonymity and call him, as we always do, George. And we don't play the little...
Okay, I'll play it.
We don't have
to. Been a while. But well, let's play it.
Just what I always wanted, my own little bunny rabbit. I will name him George, and I will hug him and pet him and squeeze him.
I'm not a bunny rabbit.
That was loud.
That was a little loud. I'll have to fix that on the recording.
Because I think we just burst the eardrums of some of our listeners, because I burst my eardrums. Okay, so he writes, foregoing 1040 ES payments... combined with estimated Roth conversions.
What end of year.
End of year Roth conversions. Would I get in trouble for this? And then he lays out what he, I'm guessing what he did.
Yeah.
On December 26, take $18,000 distribution from my traditional IRA and have the custodian withhold $8,000 in federal income taxes. And I would assume sent to the IRS by his custodian.
So that, why don't we take this in baby steps?
Sure.
What that accomplishes by withholding that, he was clearly worried about not having made estimated tax payments during the 2019. The workaround to that, the I don't know if you'd call it a loophole or a hack or whatever you want to call it, but if you have withholding from a distribution from a retirement account withheld by the custodian and sent in to the IRS, it's considered to have come in throughout the year. And if you do that withholding in order to create a situation where you have been appropriately withholding taxes through the whole year, even though you didn't actually withhold anything and send it in until the very end, he said the December 26th, you'll avoid estimated tax or the failure to make estimated tax payment penalties. So this is kind of a hack. Where
I
you
don't
can
like
get
to use
that
the word
done.
Hack. It's a strategy that Ed Slott teaches us in his program.
Hack is 2020 lingo for that kind of stuff.
2020 lingo?
Yeah. It's getting, well, maybe 2018. It's been around for a couple of years.
Oh, I thought you were talking about the ABC News show 2020. I was like...
No, no, no. It's
I didn't know. It's like 2020 uses the word hack?
No, when you like a life hack, it's not anything illegal. It's just... when you do something creative to make your life better, and this is
no hack to me is when someone breaks into my computer.
I know, but that's the 1995 version of hack.
Whatever. So, anyways, we have a gentleman who Chris interprets. See, I didn't interpret it that way, but Chris interprets that on December 26th he took out $18,000 and he sent $8,000 to the feds in taxes. But Chris is 100% correct, because this is what Ed Slott teaches us in his program all the time. If one of your clients, he says, misses their estimated payments, if you missed your first and second quarter estimated payments or your third quarter or all three quarters, and you're now in the fourth quarter, even if you paid all your tax liability in the fourth quarter, you're still going to get a penalty.
Mm-hmm.
However, if you send them the taxes instead of using their silly little coupon where you mail it in the fourth quarter, you just take all the money that you should have paid throughout the year out of your IRA and tell your custodian, send it all, send 100% withholding to the feds. They, for some bizarre reason, will consider it received equally every quarter, and it's a way you can avoid the underpayment penalty.
Yeah, and in this case, he didn't send in withholding the entire distribution because he's combining this
with another strategy.
With another thing. He's doing two things at once.
Okay. See, I interpreted it as he knew he was going to do a conversion and he knew he was going to owe taxes on it, so he just sent the taxes in. But you could be correct as well. Maybe he was fixing too low of withholdings, or maybe he was just paying the taxes. Because the next thing he does, And this has to do with the strategy that Chris and I talk about every year. We usually talk about it in October of every year. And that is doing a Roth conversion via a 60-day rollover, where you take the money out of a retirement account towards the end of December, out of your IRA most likely. You have 60 days to choose what type of IRAs you want to put that in. If any, you can just keep the money out and pay taxes on it and a 10% penalty if you're under 59 and a half. You don't have to put it back in an IRA, but it gives you up to 60 days, technically a little bit more. And if you listen to our recording we did on this, you'll understand what we mean by technically a little bit more than 60 days. But it does give you some time to make up your mind on how much money should be put into a Roth as a conversion and how much money should just go right back into the IRA as if you never took it out. In other words, as if you were trying to maximize a tax bracket, but you weren't really sure how much you were going to earn in 2019. So you're going to take out more than what you probably need. Figure it out in 2020, early 2020, as you're doing your taxes, and then put the amount you're supposed to put in, or you the optimal amount, if you will, to put in to a Roth and move the rest to an IRA. This is just a weird thing we have to do now when they got rid of the ability to do recharacterizations or undo a Roth conversion. That's how I interpreted this,
yeah.
Chris.
When you get to the third step, when I point something out, you'll see why he's asking us this question.
Is he? Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So he says in early December, he takes out $18,000 from his traditional IRA, fires off $8,000 in withholdings in 2019. So this is clearly withholdings for 2019 he's now doing, because he sent it to the IRS December 26, 2019. That leaves 10 grand. He has that 10 grand just sitting in his bank. He's not doing anything with it. He took out 18, 8 goes to the feds in taxes, 10 goes to him as a distribution. He has 60 days to get that money into an IRA or a Roth IRA. And then he writes, in early February, he figures out his taxes. Now, that makes sense, because by early February, you have all of December's income known. You probably have received most of your 1099s. You have a pretty good idea what your taxable income for 2019 was. So in early February, he figures out his taxes. Then he writes, by February 15th, he deposits $13,000 into his Roth IRA account to complete a taxable $13,000 Roth conversion. Let me stop there, folks. Chris, when does that conversion happen? Is it a 2020 conversion because he put the money in a Roth in 2020? Or is it a 2019 conversion because that's when the money came out of the IRA?
It's a 2019 conversion, because once you complete the rollover via the conversion via the 60-day rollover technique, which is what he's doing, the conversion is considered to have happened the day the money left the traditional IRA, which was back on December 26th.
2019.
They don't count the days where it was kind of in limbo out there. They essentially ignore the time period during the 60-day rollover period. It's almost like you have a time machine and you jump right to the action, the end action, skipping over that delay, that 60-day period.
Right. When you have the money, they're just considering it in purgatory, if you will.
Yeah.
But the conversion happens not the day the money goes into the Roth, but the day the money came out of the IRA. It's one of those bizarre rules that make this strategy work. That's why we talk about it once a year. So, nonetheless, he put the money in on February 15th, he put in $13,000.
Into the Roth.
Now, that completes a 2019 conversion of $13,000. Mm-hmm. He took out $18,000.
Yep.
He gave $8 to the feds in taxes. Now, you might be saying, but Jimmy only has $10,000 left over. How can he put $13,000 in? This isn't adding up, Jim. Well, it does, actually, if you follow some of our logic and what he did. So, on December 15th, he puts $13,000 into a Roth. That makes a 2019 conversion of $13,000.
Yep, it's taxable. Yep.
Then he deposits $5,000 back into his traditional IRA to complete a rollover that's not taxable to him. The thing that's throwing him for a loop, and threw me for a loop too, was the $8,000 he sent to the government in taxes.
Right. He's effectively putting some of, quote, that money back into the IRA.
Exactly.
And he's thinking they're going to call a foul on this.
But I didn't ask the Ed Slot Group this, and I think I'll fire this off to the Ed Slot Group just
this
to make sure I'm right.
This isn't going to cause a problem.
But I'm 99.9% sure my interpretation was correct because of one thing. Well, two things. First, courts, tax court, and the IRS has ruled consistently using this verbiage. Money is fungible. Mm-hmm. So they don't track the actual distribution and say, oh, you sent $8,000 to the feds. You took $10,000. You can only roll over $10,000. And this is what's going to mess everything up. They don't do that. They say, all your money is fungible. In fact, they have ruled the money that actually goes back into your IRA or Roth IRA could come from someone else. It doesn't even have to come from the original money you took out. So that was the first reason why I thought this guy's going to be fine. But the second reason, Chris, because it's already, I guess you could say, established fact, if you will. If you took money from your 401k, if he tried to do this with a 401k, and took took $18,000 from his 401k, $3,600 of that 18 would have automatically gone to the IRS. And the rule says you have to put $18,000 back into an IRA within 60 days and make up the $3,600 from your own money.
Right.
Or it will be taxable to you,
yep.
Even though it went to the IRS. Mm-hmm. So as I started considering that, I thought, well, wait a minute, this guy's okay.
Yep.
Because of that rule. They let you take it from a 401k. They know the law states a direct rollover, a cash withdrawal, if you will, from a 401k, 20% of it must go to the IRS. And the IRS has said, if you want to complete that as a 60-day rollover, you must make up from your own money the 20% that went to us in taxes, right. Or we're going to tax it.
Right. And then it all comes out in the wash when you file your taxes. If you end up having to have withheld or sent in too much, you get it back as a tax refund. Same thing is going on here. There's a timing issue that he was concerned this would raise a red flag.
Yep.
And I'm going to go out on a limb and say I'm 100% sure that this would work, given the facts, unless there's something else going on.
I'm 99.99.
But there's, unless there's some other gotcha in here he's not sharing with us that he did, there's really no reason why he can't. Because he will have completed movement of the entire $18,000 properly. He will have recognized $13,000 of it as a taxable distribution that was actually a Roth conversion, right? And the other $5,000 he put back in order to avoid taxes
and
on
he
it,
still
and still
sent $8,000 to the feds,
and
but money is fungible.
Yep. Yeah, yeah. So he played a game. He played a little game that was allowed with the timing. He got a withholding that got it to count in 2019 when he really didn't wash it out and fix it all until 2020. But it still counts as a 2019 withholding to protect him from not making his estimated tax payments during 2019.
So again, listener, Chris feels 100% sure. I feel, and that's why when I got your email today, I actually contemplated this in the morning. I checked my emails and I saw this, and I'm thinking about it in the morning as I'm getting ready to go to work. And I thought, geez, I think I might get a hold of the Ed Slot Group. But then, Chris, as I started thinking, I was like, well, wait a minute. Courts have ruled consistently money is fungible. Money that goes back into your IRA does not have to. In fact, the Barbro case pointed that out. The IRS was saying in the Barbro case from last year or the year before, that seminal case that made rollovers one per year instead of one per IRA, the Barbro case, the tax courts ruled money is fungible. Mm-hmm. You do not track what the people do with it.
Right. The fact that it came from another source to put it back wasn't the problem.
Nope. The tax court said that was no
fine.
Problem.
Yep, exactly.
So if money is fungible, who cares if some of your money, once it leaves the IRA, it's a distribution. Who cares if the money that went to the IRS came from the IRA or came from a bank account? Went to the IRS.
Yep. It's still yours. It's sitting there
exactly.
Until you owe the taxes.
It just so happens when it goes from your IRA to the IRS, they'll divide it up as if it was received equally throughout the year. So if he was trying to avoid a underpayment tax penalty, that was a brilliant move.
Yeah, I think that's what he was doing, and he was worried that he would get caught doing something, and he's not doing anything wrong, in my opinion.
And I feel strongly because the IRS makes it clear if you're going to do a rollover from a 401k, mm-hmm. you must get that 20% that was sent to them. You must get that into the IRA as well within 60 days, or that money that went to them will be subject to taxes and a 10% penalty if you were under 59.5. Well, that money that went to them, Chris, has to come from another account.
Yep.
So why would it be different here?
Yep.
So anyways, I think I might still fire this out to the SLOT group just to confirm. But we feel pretty confident. Chris feels very confident. And I feel 99.9% confident. All right. Are we all set?
Yep.
This one is a more apropos in light of what everything is happening. Chris and I are recording this on Monday afternoon. And
Thursday afternoon.
No, it's not Monday. It is. It feels like a Monday.
Kind of.
It is Thursday afternoon, mm-hmm. and we missed our regular Monday.
Tuesday recording.
Mm-hmm. Goodness.
The whole week's just going.
This whole
week, we just want to skip. This is a very, very traumatic week in lots of ways.
Yes. Anyways, I don't even know where the hell I am anymore. We're on Thursday afternoon.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's not Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday. Anyways, I wanted to get to this. We are recording this on Thursday afternoon when the equity markets had tanked a lot today after tanking a lot on Monday and a lot on Wednesday. They kind of recouped a little bit on Tuesday. And everything is going to hell in a handbasket over a coronavirus that...
Well, it feels like everything's going to hell in a handbasket.
It's a panic. I mean, if ever you wanted to see a panic, this is a panic. And this email came in to us. And I jump it to the top of the queue, Chris, because I think it can help a lot of listeners. So it begins, Hi, Jai and Chris. I think he forgot the M, or does J-I mean something? Is that in another language?
J-I?
Is he being, like, facetious to me?
I think it was J-I. I think he just skipped the M. Don't be so sensitive.
All right, well, I didn't know if he was picking on me. Hi, Jai and Chris. I think he meant Jim. Hi, Jim and Chris. I have listened to your podcast for several years, and at first, I thought your approach was rather, quote-unquote, old school.
Hmm.
Yeah. I don't think it's old school. I think it's cutting edge.
Well, it's all perspective.
I would have liked cutting edge better. Mm-hmm. Anyways, I have listened to your podcast for several years, and at first, I thought your approach was rather, quote-unquote, old school and lacked any potential for growth.
Hmm.
However, as I get deeper into my own retirement, I am beginning to see your point and understand why you use your minimum dignity floor and secure income strategy for retirement funding.
Mm-hmm.
The markets are completely irrational, I'd say insane, and they are making me feel quite uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any advice for those of us who are basing their retirement on funding on a withdrawal strategy and are freaking out, as you often say on your podcast? And how can I move from a withdrawal strategy to a secure retirement strategy without decimating my assets at this point by selling low?
It's a tough question. Mm-hmm. I'm glad he sent it to you.
No, he sent it to Jai. And Jai's not here. He sent it to Jai and Chris.
Yeah.
Wow. There's a lot going on here. Mm-hmm. Before we try to address his freaking out, and I think he references that from, because I say a lot to our listeners all the time, that when you retire and you stop working and you realize there is no more money coming in, and then I used to say, or still say, and combine that with a down market, it is going to freak you out. Yeah. And he's being freaked out.
Mm-hmm. Did he say how old he is?
Negative.
Okay. He's just retired, right?
I'm going to guess he's retired because he says, as I get deeper into my own retirement, I'm beginning to see your point.
Yeah.
Okay. The first thing I don't want to tell this person not to worry, because I don't know what you have. We're not in a retirement planning agreement. I don't know what your asset situation is, your secure income, your expenses, your life expectancy, if you're married, if you're single. And even if I knew all that, we wouldn't be answering that deep of a question on a radio show without crunching any numbers.
But he can do this on his own. I think he's freaked out and forgetting the first step in our approach, which I don't care where you are in your retirement, you could absolutely do. He needs to take a look at what his minimum dignity floor is, mm-hmm. identify it, and then compare it to the secure income that he has coming in, which shouldn't, in our description of secure income, hasn't been affected by this market irrationality or craziness that's been going on lately. Your Social Security hasn't gone down because the market's freaked out. Your annuity payments, if you have any, hasn't gone down because it's freaked out. If you have turned on your pension and the pension is coming out, generally, if you have the type of pension we're describing, those payments haven't stopped or gone down because the market is freaking out, because they're not based on those things directly. They are, you know, even if they're based at all, it's, you know, 6 or 7 steps of separation, so it's really insulated. And he might discover, and I'm going to cross my fingers for him, that he might discover that his minimum dignity floor is actually pretty well protected. I think just doing that would calm a lot of people if they realize, if you have a decent amount of Social Security, particularly if you have a two-income family where you have two people with decent-sized Social Security, oftentimes we find that most of a couple's minimum dignity floor is covered by their Social Security benefits. Mm-hmm. If there's only one benefit and then maybe a spousal or something, or if you turned on your Social Security really early because of a variety of reasons you chose to do that, you can have undermined the coverage. So I'm not going to say everybody's going to find this, but a surprising number of people are surprised to find that their Social Security and maybe a little pension that they might still have. A lot of people retiring now have a little old pension out there or something. Their minimum dignity floor is actually in better shape than they thought. And that should immediately allow you to say, take a breath and say, okay, well, this means at least my minimum dignity floor isn't subject to this craziness that's going on now.
Or it might be underfunded, but not until later in mm-hmm. your retirement, you'll find. We call that the mm-hmm. crossover point. So in other words, initially you might find, wow, it looks like my Social Security, and again, I don't even know if he's collecting Social Security, he doesn't say, but do that analysis, because we often see in the office, especially in the case where people have similar, a married couple has similar levels of Social Security benefits to fairly good earning spouses, that a lot of your minimum dignity floor needs will be covered, especially early in your retirement. So maybe some of your quote-unquote freaking out is a little irrational right now. I don't know. Or you could be in a mm-hmm. situation where it's not well covered. And yeah, now you're going to have to start looking at some things. But I agree with Chris, which was a direction I wasn't going to go with as I was contemplating an answer here. But I like that. Just start looking at your minimum dignity floor. And remember, folks, that is the expenses associated with food, utilities, transportation, housing, and health care. And on transportation, it's the maintenance, upkeep, and replacement of one vehicle. If you are a married couple or even a single person like me, I got three cars and a truck. But I don't drive them all at once, and they're all not all brand new, so don't get all, oh my God, Jim just goes out and buys new vehicles. No, I've got old stuff, but I got an old pickup truck for hunting and fishing and firewood. I've got a newer Lexus, for my regular driving. I got a Subaru for the hiking, and a Jetta that I've had for a long time that I now give to employees of ours when they come out and visit here, and I let them drive it.
But the point is you could get by with one if you needed to.
I can get one. If there's an emergency, and I have to have a minimum amount of money, I only need one vehicle. So start looking at that. I like that approach, Chris, and that might help you feel a little calmer. What I want to talk to everyone about as well, not just this gentleman, is why we've been preaching for years on this podcast, we do retirement this way. We haven't had a market correction since we started this podcast. Were we running the podcast in 08? When the not the podcast, but
the radio show started in 09.
Did it start in 09? Okay. So we haven't even been able to talk to our listeners about a down market.
We had a recent, it was fresh in our memory at that time.
Because of 09.
So we had a lot to talk about at the time, but you're right. I hadn't really thought about that. But the entire time we've been preaching this,
there hasn't
has
been a
been
correction
during a 11-year bull market.
Exactly. And we had a, I won't even call it, well, no, it was technically a correction because it was more than a 10% loss, but it wasn't a bear market in the fourth quarter of 2018. And the reason that one didn't stick in people's minds, it was a V ending. A V ending is when it just hits one day, turns, and boom, just goes through the roof. And that was in late December of 2018. The market just finished dropping 19.8%, market being the S&P 500, 19.8%, did a V bottom, and just took off.
Yep.
And all of 2019, the market was up. Now, everybody, and we talked about this on the podcast, Chris, everybody in 2019 was ecstatic that they were up a lot, and I would just point out to people, and I kept saying, instead of just looking at 2019, measure from the fourth quarter of 2018 to now and tell me how you're doing. And then people would realize, well, I'm
up, but not as aggressive, you know, not up, as amazing.
I'm barely up.
Yeah.
Because most of the return of 2019 was to recoup the 19.8% loss in the fourth quarter of 2018.
Right. Okay. So we're back to, and one thing I want to point out is, and this is accumulation period thinking process. You'll hear a lot of people trying to calm nerves by saying, oh, you know, get a grip. We haven't given up 11 years of returns. We've only dialed back to January of 2019. We've given up just over a year's worth. If you look at where the S&P was in January, the very beginning of January, and today as we're talking, we're just back to there. And they're saying that to try to calm you down, to say, well, it's no worse than we were back in January. Now the next week looks a lot uglier than the second week of January back in 2019. But the problem in retirement when you're distributing, you can't just calm your nerves and say, fine, I'm not going to lock in these losses because I'm not going to sell at the bottom. I'm going to control my emotions. I'm just going to ride through this. And just like so far every other time in history, assuming that we're not going to, you know, change the trajectory of humankind moving forward, every other time there's been this, it covers, it comes back and goes up, and I should feel better about that. What's different in distribution phase, you're being forced to sell if you're withdrawing money to live on when it's down.
Exactly.
So you don't let someone, I mean, I'm not trying to ratchet up your nerves, but let's be realistic. You aren't in the same position as if you were 45, not retired yet, and in a position to just ride this thing out for fill-in-the-blank length of time until we're back to somewhat normalcy, and we aren't at the, you know, this tragedy situation that we've got going on right now. So this is also why we preach our approach. You don't want to be put in a position to being forced to liquidate just to meet basic living needs, because Murphy's Law says you're going to have times when there you'll be forced to do it when you don't want to. And this is now when you don't want to. You'd like to. It would be better to draw upon resources, whether it be secure income coming in, using that, or drawing on some type of cushion or bucket that's been protected from these market irrational declines, and sleep easier at night knowing that you haven't been forced to sell into this chaos.
Exactly. And this is the worst time to make a decision, listener and listeners in general, when you're under duress, when you're not feeling good, when you're being irrational. It's a rational mind. This is why I hate, by the way, risk tolerance questionnaires, because you answer them with a rational mind.
Right.
But you experience them with an irrational mind. Mm-hmm. Risk tolerance questionnaires aren't even worth the paper they're printed on. I just wish you would let the regulators and the compliance people know that, because they keep insisting you use some type of risk tolerance questionnaire.
Amen to that right there.
But nonetheless, that's why we don't use them in the office. We just don't. They're worthless. But right now, listener, you're thinking a little bit irrationally. It's called recency bias, by the way, that you take things that are happening to you right now and just feel they're going to happen forever or for a very, very long time.
Yeah. You're putting more weight on what's recent rather than more historical information.
From a market perspective, mm-hmm. you have to look for capitulation for a down market, a bear market to end. With a 10% drop in the market today nearly, and a 8 or 9% drop on Monday, granted a 6% recovery on Tuesday and a near 5% loss on Wednesday. There's a lot of irrationality here, but one could argue we might be close to a capitulation. But I'm not saying this is a market bottom. I'm saying I don't know.
Who knows? Mm-hmm.
But what you don't want to do is sell when the market is already down almost 25%. In a very short period of time, being driven by a disease that, granted, is scary, is not something I want to catch, is deadly for a certain percent of the population, but relatively speaking, more people die in an auto accident in a day than this disease has killed worldwide, probably. So keep it in perspective. It's not to say this isn't going to get worse. A doctor client was in the office yesterday. He seems to think exactly what I had told Scott. Scott is a gentleman who works for us. And I was talking to Scott just before the doctor came in. And then the doctor came in and started talking to us about this. And Scott looked at me and said, "Did you talk to him ahead of time?" And what I had shared with Scott was that I feel eventually, as the weather warms up, this disease is going to die down. No pun intended. It's not going away. It's going to die down because that's what these types of viruses do. Cold and flu viruses are not as prevalent in warmer, moist weather as they are in cooler, drier weather. That's why you have a cold and flu season. And I said, I bet you this thing starts to die down. Economies begin to recover because people have very short memories thanks to recency bias. And everyone starts to think life is great. Summer is beautiful. Let's go on our trips. Let's do this. Everything is fine until it starts getting cold again. And now the disease is already here and already throughout the world, and it comes back even worse. That's what I said I think is going to happen, and that's worth about as much as a nickel will get you.
Or we can hope that natural immunities have kicked in by then, because that's what happens when you are exposed to something new. The population, this is a novel virus. Let's not get medical.
So anyways,
that's outside of our scope.
What I'm saying is it could cause a very volatile fall again, is all I'm getting to, where the disease is coming back. We still don't have a vaccine, and even if they develop a vaccine, it takes at least a year to get through human trials to bring it. I know I'm not going to go out and get injected by something that hasn't gone through trials. So it's still going to take at least a year to even reasonably get a vaccine. And it may come back in the middle of a very contentious presidential election and bode for a very volatile fall and a pretty ugly year in the markets. Mm-hmm. So that's what I said I think would happen. And then a doctor client came in and said, hey, here's what I think is going to happen. And he kind of laid out exactly what I just said. And I'm certainly not
and
a
don't,
doctor.
Everyone's still focused on the health thing going on. But remember the Saudi-Russia battle that's going on that happens simultaneously with this. That's hammering the markets, too. It's a double whammy. Warren Buffett just talked about it. He's right. Not seen this kind of double whammy happening all at once.
That's two black swans.
In his 89 years. He said he had to wait 89 years to see a double whammy like this.
Well, now you see why we preach that certain part of your retirement should have nothing to do with the market. Retirement planning is not the same as retirement saving. Accumulation, and I'll say this again, and we said it recently, if you're in your 20s, 30s, and 40s, and maybe even for some of you, or a good portion of you, you're early to mid-50s, if you are in the accumulation phase, this is a non-issue. Keep saving. Don't change your allocation. Don't sell for your retirement money now, folks. Other money, if you needed money in a year or two to buy a house and you had it in the markets, shame on you. But if you are still saving for retirement and you're in your 20s, 30s, or 40s, goodness, start looking at the amount of shares you're buying with every contribution as opposed to how much those shares are worth. You're buying more. It's a sale. But if you are in the transitional phase or retired like this listener, yeah, now you can start to see, as he said, why we believe in not doing this with withdrawals. Could you imagine, listeners, being 80, 85 years old right now, worried already because you're in the population that is most susceptible to dying from this, unfortunately, and you're also trying to deal with withdrawals from a portfolio? Please.
It's been hammered, yeah.
You just want steady lifetime income where you're not worrying about anything. So let's get back to his original question, Chris. What can he do about this? Well, I love your first suggestion. Start looking at your minimum dignity floor. Compare it to your existing or expected secure income. Secure income, folks, is not. How many questions do we have on this, Chris? Now you see why. We don't consider secure income, listeners, dividends and interest. They're not secure. How many questions have we got when we talk about this? Well, can I consider my dividend portfolio part of my secure income?
Well, watch what happens now. All those companies, not all of them, but a bunch of them are going to cut or eliminate dividends right at a time when you need them. And you say, well, no, I've got a bond portfolio. Well, what are rates right now?
Next to zero. And bonds today on Thursday. We're recording this Thursday, September what? It is...
It's March.
Oh, whatever. What is it? Today's
March
the 13th.
12th.
You sure? I think it's the 13th.
It's close, but it's the
12th. No.
Yeah.
Oh, it is. Son of a gun. All right. So today is Thursday, March 12th, 2020, in case you're listening to this to another day. And bonds were down big today. Gold was down. Silver was down. Bonds were down. Stocks were down. Everything was down. And you even said today, where are everyone putting their money? I mean, it's got to go somewhere. Yeah. It's going to cash, I suppose. Brokerage maybe. Cash reserves.
Banks, maybe, yeah.
But anyways, everything is down. So bonds aren't this risk-free investment either for your minimum dignity floor. The rates have been cut, so your income is dropping, and your principal on it is dropping, and it's going to be freaking you out. Start looking at your minimum dignity floor as Social Security, pension, and income annuities. Yes, those evil, vile annuities. Let the insurance company, a big, well-funded, A-plus rated insurance company, who can easily absorb this temporary...
Ride it out.
Mm-hmm. Let them absorb this risk. And annuities also give you mortality credits. There are going to be some people who pass away before you. And you get to share in the money they never got. So the mortality credits and the risk pooling of annuities, same thing with pensions are funded with mortality credits and risk pooling, and Social Security, which is funded with tax dollars, all backed by deep-pocketed third parties. So anyways, what you want to start doing, like Chris said, figure out your minimum dignity floor, look at your secure income. Maybe that will make you feel a little nicer. But if it is a shortage and you want to start repositioning your assets, now might not be the time to do it. Now might not be the time to sell something that dropped and buy a income annuity with it. It may not be the time for that. So start looking at your portfolio, though, listener. Unless you have everything in one or two funds and you thought the funds were going to do everything, you hopefully have some bond holdings, some stock holdings, maybe some cash holdings, maybe some real estate. I don't know what you have. But start looking, Chris, and I think what I'm trying to get him to understand is maybe not everything is down. Mm-hmm. Some things are up. Maybe he can reposition some of that into this secure process that we do. Just don't panic if you can avoid it and sell everything down. I doubt you need all this money right away. You're just looking at it and panicking. Start calm. Take a swig of coffee. If you're in Colorado, you can take a swig of something else. But chill out and look at this a little bit, and maybe some of your assets are doing okay. I was chatting with some people today. One person, after I showed them, was down less than 2%. They had forgotten that a lot of their holdings were in very low volatile holdings. It wasn't that we were brilliant in managing their assets. We positioned it to be in a very low risk account. And I'm not saying that you're in the same boat, but not everything may be down 20% merely because the market's down 20 or 25. So start looking at your situation. And if you have to reposition or you want to add more secure income, you might be able to selectively choose the assets to move mm-hmm. without selling down. And for those of you who are still unsure if you want to do a withdrawal strategy or our minimum dignity floor secure income strategy at least, and then cover your fund spending with withdrawals, now you can start to see why we recommend that. We haven't had a bear market yet on this podcast. Welcome to it. And for those of you who are unsure, how many times have we asked this, Chris, when it comes to bucketing, or what I now call positioning, because bucketing is being overused by everyone and their uncle trying to sell annuities and things like that. If you're going to position your assets for spending, why we say the first 2 to 5 years should be in cash. Because a drop, Chris, I have always said this, happens fast. And this one was wicked fast. Mm-hmm. And what if that was some of your fund money that just dropped 15, 20, 25%? You're going to have to cut a good chunk of your fund spending. Now, granted, if your fund spending had to do with travel, you might not be hurt because travel is down quite a bit.
You can't travel anyway right now, yeah.
But even if you got there right now, there ain't nothing to do because everything's closed globally. But what we're saying with the positioning of your fund money and why we want you to have 2 to 5 years in cash, this is why. On future podcasts, we're going to be talking about Corona 2020. This is why we tell you to do this. And this is why we say the next tranche of money should be in principal protection and in very, very low risk bonds, such as ultra short bond funds or short bond funds, intermediate and longer term bond funds or junk bond funds were hit today. Now, granted, a 3, 4, 5, 6% drop relative to what stocks are down isn't much. But it can still scare you, Chris, if that was money you thought was protected. Bonds are not protected as well, and you could run into trouble. Yeah. Anyways.
And before we get to our next question, we'll do another question, but also don't run out and panic and claim your Social Security based on wrong emotions.
Yes.
Because that is a permanent decision that will linger for the rest of your life. Maybe you want to, but make sure it's a reasoned, calculated, rational decision. Don't rush out and change your plan just because of what has happened. Maybe it turns out you should, maybe not, but that's another thing you could, I've seen people panic on, and then a couple years in, they regret it because things have calmed down and they realize they just put themselves in a permanent reduction of Social Security benefits for the rest of their life.
Exactly.
And possibly punishing their spouse as well.
Yep.
So,
anyways, we have a question now we're going to talk about on pensions, and let's get to that. We beat this horse to death. And actually, it's three questions we're going to answer. Three for the price of one.
Nice.
This
well,
is like,
I'm going to count it as three so we can claim that we answered like
well, it is three.
Seven.
It's three actual separate questions that all have to do with the same topic. This is like Neapolitan ice cream.
Perfect.
We got all three flavors. Mm-hmm. We're going to wipe out one question. Well, three questions with one answer. That's what I'm trying to say. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this all came in. They started coming in... goodness, we have them from February mostly, January, February, and March. So three questions,
3 months,
3 months,
one answer.
They all had to do with pension.
Oh.
So let me read the three questions, and then mm-hmm. you'll see that one answer will satisfy three.
Okay.
Okay, so this one came in. Didn't really say where he's from. I like when they say, but anyways, I don't know. So they're from somewhere. And he asked, how do I determine if my company's pension plan is secure? It is not offered by a state or government. Mm. He does list the company. I'll probably not mention the company, but I will say this is a massively huge company with a product that everyone has probably used at some point in their life. But he goes on to say it is not a state or government plan. Is it safer for me to take the lump sum and just purchase an annuity through a major insurance company such as New York Life? So that was one question.
But we're going to not answer that until...
Well, I'm going to read all three.
Okay.
And then we'll answer the question.
Okay.
Okay. Oh, wait. Made a mistake. That's not the question. That was one that I wanted to get to. Okay, this one comes from North Carolina, mm-hmm. and he begins, Dear Jim and Steve, oh, a comedian, Dear Jim and Steve,
I like him.
And then he put Chris.
Perfect.
Okay, well, we'll skip this question, let's go on, but anyways, he begins, Dear Jim and Steve, and then he said, Chris, I love the show and the info you provide. I have a question about pensions. As they help cover the minimum dignity floor. Mm-hmm. Everyone worries about Social Security going away, or at least being reduced in the future, unless the jack wagons in Washington, he used a different word, mm-hmm. But since I got in trouble for saying
no, we got it.
One word, mm-hmm. I'm not going to say this word, unless the jack wagons in Washington finally do something to prop it up. But my concern has to do more with pensions. How will you know if your pension is safe? Companies sometimes eliminate pensions when they go bankrupt or when they renegotiate with unions. Also, some companies have underfunded their pension plans. Before deciding whether or not I should take a benefit, annuity benefit, or a lump sum when leaving an employer, how can one best determine the financial stability of their pension plan? Mm-hmm. Thanks and keep up the good work. Okay, that was the second question.
Mm-hmm. I see how that aligns with the first one.
I thought
they're not brothers or anything that you know of?
Not that I know of.
Maybe it's the same person and they just sent it in three times.
I checked that.
To get improved chances of getting answered.
No, one is... The emails are not the same.
I'm kidding.
Oh. Well, it could be the same mm-hmm. and just has different mm-hmm. emails. Okay. And the third one. I invested my Roth IRA at Vanguard. I'm 39 years old. I have a risky pension at work. My union keeps sending me letters telling me that my pension is underfunded. So I thought all of these kind of related to each other.
Was there a question there or just?
No, that was pretty much it. I think he emailed us earlier.
And that was a follow-up?
I think so. I think he wanted to know what I thought about using a target date fund in his Roth IRA. So we'll answer that part of the question later. What I wanted to key on this, and again, this I'm pretty sure because he's got a unique email address. I'm pretty sure he emailed us with a question on that, and then this was a follow-up, and he just thought I was going to be able to put two and two together.
So he's worried about the pension as well.
Yes, he's 39 years old. Mm-hmm. He has a risky pension, obviously through a union, and his union keeps sending him letters telling him that his pension is underfunded. So here we have a union saying, hey, you got to watch out. Your pension is underfunded. And two other people, one who works because he listed the company for a major, major company. I know you haven't seen this. I'll let you see the company. It is a product that we have all used. I can all but guarantee you every American has used this product.
Toilet paper?
So, no. Okay. But you have used this product. It's a food company. I'll say that. Mm. And he's worried about the strength of the pension.
Is it related to the Patriots in some way?
Food related to... Oh, Kraft. No.
Oh, okay.
Is that how Kraft made his money? Is he the Kraft guy?
I don't know. That's my... I'm just... I was doing a word
connection. I wonder if he's the guy who started Kraft.
I don't think so.
Oh, is it different Kraft?
I have no idea.
No, Robert, I think it's Kraft just
no. I don't think it has anything to do with the Kraft company. I might be wrong. I should look it up. But why don't you? Why don't we go back to more important things?
Sure. Well, you yeah, started squirrel. You mentioned the New England Patriots, and that just distracts me.
I got it.
You realize my Tom Brady in another 5 days is a free agent.
I've heard that. Mm-hmm. Might be a Charger.
I'm having sleepless nights
or a Raider.
Between coronavirus, the stock market, and my Tom Brady threatening to leave the New England Patriots, I'm not sleeping much. Okay, so, and the third question, Chris, again, was saying, hey, everybody's worried about Social Security. What about those of us with a pension? How do I know if I should take a lump sum or the pension? So all of these questions, folks, really revolve around determining the health of a pension. Well, there's a few things to know. Most pensions will be, well, I don't want to say, well, yeah, I would say most are, but not all pensions are covered by the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, PBGC. The PBGC, for short, is the federal government. The federal government has a little division of the government, if you will, called the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. They collect premiums from pension plans. Tax dollars do not go to this. Now, that's not to say if the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation ever ran out of money, tax dollars would not be used to bail it out. But right now, they're proud to say that tax dollars do not support the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. They instead collect premiums from private and pension plans. And they use those premiums to fund a series of investments. They pretty much invest only in government bonds, so they're not earning very much on that right now. Anyone who's tried to buy bonds recently will tell you. But they do have money that they collect in premiums. They do invest it, if you will, in government bonds. And they will use that money to pay pension benefits to pension plans that go bankrupt. Now, the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation does not cover unions. Now, they do offer protection under a separate program that's a little bit different than Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. So for the union guy, you do have to watch out that some union plans are not going to be covered. Some will be.
Well, you're assuming it's a union plan. He might just work at a place that has a union, and they're actually critical of ownership that has an underfunded pension. So you're assuming it's a union pension.
I was assuming that, yes.
It may not be. Just putting that out there.
Okay.
May or may not be.
Chris's point is maybe your pension is being offered by the private employer.
Right.
The union is something separate,
right,
and the union is warning you that your pension is underfunded.
Right.
Maybe the union's trying to get in there and take over and offer a pension or negotiate a better deal. I don't know. So Chris is right. I was being a little presumptive. So for the gentleman who had the union question, I think one of the things you may want to do is find out, is the pension actually a union pension, or is it a private pension? And is the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation involved at all with it? But unions are generally exempt from the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, and so are government pensions. Now, again, unions do have, some unions under a separate insurance program will be covered with some protections from the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. Kind of like Social Security, Chris, has the retirement pool, and then they have a disability pool. It's kind of all under the Social Security Administration, but they get these different pots of money. The Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation has a plan for unions, and they have a plan for private employers. It's important to know which one you have, because your benefits that, or protections, if you will, if the pensions go under, are going to be a little bit different. Now, I am by no means an expert on the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, but I do go to their website a lot, and I am going to recommend you go to their website. It's just PBGC, Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation.gov. Fairly easy to remember. Mm-hmm. But if you go there, it's written in a lot of plain English that anyone can understand the protections that you'll receive and ways to research your company's pension. And that was another question. What are we supposed to do? So one of the things that you have to do if you're trying to determine the health of your pension is, first, the person who had the question that said he kind of was insinuating sometimes they eliminate pensions when they go bankrupt or renegotiate with unions. That's what someone wrote, one of the questions. Keep in mind, your pension is protected in the event the company goes bankrupt. Now, they can stop offering a pension plan and freeze it, and your benefits are locked in up to what you had earned, and they're going to say, look, we're just not going to offer a pension anymore. We're offering this type of plan or that type of plan. We see that a lot. But if your pension is still there and the company declares bankruptcy, they can't raid that plan. The bankruptcy trustee cannot raid that plan because your pension is not your employer's money. It's not a slush fund. It's not an operational fund for your employer. Now, prior to ERISA, the Employee Retirement Income Security Act of 1973, prior to that, mm-hmm. pension plans were used as slush right. funds.
Yep.
And there were problems. That's why ERISA, that law passed in 73, to kind of put this wall between the employer and the employer's pension.
Now, that being said, if the pension is underfunded and then they go bankrupt, the pension then is permanently underfunded. So
exactly.
the benefits may be reduced from what you thought you were going to get, but they can't reach in there and take the money out to try to save themselves from going bankrupt or to blow the money or something like that. So it's there are effects for a failing company on a pension, especially when it was underfunded as they approach failure. So it's not that you are unharmed, but he did kind of say it like they were going to raid the pension plan and drain it as they were going bankrupt. And there are luckily protections now against that.
So what all of you with pensions need to do as you're trying to decide, because Chris and I are huge believers in pensions, especially the gentleman who asked the first question, should he take the lump sum and use a private annuity from a highly rated insurance company, and he chose the highest rated insurance company in America, New York Life, as an example. And he said, would I be better off taking a lump sum from my pension, going to New York Life and buying an annuity? It might make you sleep better at night if you have an underfunded or a low funded or a worry about your pension. However, your benefit will be no way near
yeah.
what the pension is going to offer you, because your pension payments, folks, are based on your salary and your years of work, whereas an annuity payment is based on what, Chris?
Current interest rates.
Current interest rates. And where are interest rates right now?
A little low.
You think?
Yeah.
Current interest rates are so low, dollar for dollar, you will get no way near what your pension is going to offer you in a lifetime guaranteed income stream.
And he phrased the question, would it be safer? And the answer to that is yes.
Maybe. I don't want to say yes.
I would say,
if you've got a pension plan from a major employer,
you'd put it on par with an insurance company of the rating of New York Life. Now, I would
but
admit,
don't forget, you have
that
pension
marginally safer. I think that there is not much. There are certain pensions that are so robust that there's not going to be much difference, where others would be great. But I don't know. I guess I'd...
Technically speaking, if I had to choose what is more secure, a lifetime income annuity backed by New York Life, the highest rated insurance company in America today, or a pension plan, okay, if I had to choose one, I would choose the annuity company, obviously, because New York Life is so highly funded.
Just from a safety standpoint. But what Jim said is absolutely true. The trade-off, which might be for just a minute amount of extra safety, if you have a good pension plan, you're going to take a massive cut in benefit. Yeah, exactly.
Because an annuity payment, New York Life, and we're just using them because that's the company you listed, and I think you chose them because they're the highest rated company. New York Life doesn't care what you earned during your working career. They're going to base your annuity payment on your life expectancy and your sex. It's as easy as that. So they're going to look at your age. They're going to look at your sex. They have their own life expectancy tables. Then they're going to look at current interest rates, lock those current interest rates in, and give you a payment based on all of those variables. So right now, you're not going to get diddly squat because current interest rates are so low. And when I say you're not going to get diddly squat, you're not going to get diddly squat compared to what a pension would pay you, because those payments are based on your salary. Now, your lump sum payments are going to be based also on current interest rates. The formula they use to determine your lump sum payment will be based on current interest rates. But they get to use a different interest rate. I forget which one it is. It's one that is beneficial to the employer. It's a higher interest rate than what the 10-year note is paying right now, 0.8%. And because it's a higher interest rate, the lump sum payment is smaller. The higher the interest rate, I think they get to use the average of the 30-year corporate.
Yeah, they really don't want you to take the money out, so they do everything they can to make the lump sum not particularly attractive to be honest with you. They offer it as a choice, but they don't want you to take that out of there.
Argue some pensions do
some
want
do.
You to get the
some,
hell out.
Some do, because the promise
is harder to keep. See, the thing is, what they want to do, folks, is give you an actuarially sound lump sum payout that favors them. So they're going to use a current interest rate higher than what the income annuity company is going to be using to factor in your payout. So the income annuity is going to be keying off of the 10-year bond, whereas the payout, I believe, uses the average of 30-year corporate, which is going to be higher than a 10-year government bond. So the interest rate that they use to determine a lump sum payout favors them in these low interest rate environments, because they use a slightly higher interest rate and means the lump sum payment is smaller. But then when you take that payout and you go and try to buy an income annuity, you quickly realize, I can't get an income annuity paying. This isn't working. Well, that's one of the reasons why they're using different interest rates. But also, your annuity payment is based more on your salary, not current rates. So, yes, to the listener's question who said, would it be safer? I'll concede Chris's point. Perhaps a company like New York Life is theoretically safer. But I also think you need to really look at the health of your pension before assuming that. So how do you all determine the health of your...
And combine it with the backing of the pension.
Correct.
The PBGC coverage, your pension may not be all that great, but maybe once you factor in the PBGC protection, your the amount you are going to be paid falls under the protected amount with PBGC, so there may be very little to worry about.
Right, and you have to understand how PBGC works, Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. They have a maximum amount, and they tell you openly on their website, your pension payments may be lower than what you're going to get under their coverage. So go to their website and see. I think the max coverage protected now is 50-something thousand a
no,
year.
No, it's age-based.
Oh, is it age-based?
It's age-based. Okay. So you can get, if your pension fails as you're older, the payout cap is higher.
Okay.
So it used to be a flat amount, I'm pretty sure, because yeah. we were taught a long time ago in school that it was this flat amount. But I was at the PBGC site not long ago in the past year and saw there was a schedule, and it was based on your age. And the older you were and your, you know, when it got handed over to PBGC, the limit that they would pay you was higher. And it was, in a lot of cases, substantially higher than the number you quoted.
Okay. So go to the website and learn what your protection would be based on your current age or your expected future age where you think the pension may fail. And if that protected amount is greater than your pension, you've got a pretty good backing there. Now, granted, the tax dollars don't support the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, but I don't see if the that part of the government ever failed to have the funding that they wouldn't provide the money. But, of course, there's no certainties in life. Just like there's no certainties the pension never will go bankrupt or New York Life will never go out of business. Not that I ever see that happening, but one never knows. You can't say for certain. Nobody saw coronavirus coming 2 years ago, and now here it is. So things can happen. But don't just blanketly fear your pension. There are protections. The first thing you got to make sure is that your pension is covered. If it's a union pension, it's probably a multi-employer pension is what they call it. So that type of pension is going to be covered a little bit differently. If you go to the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation's website, they explain all that. And they show you what actually happens in the multi-employer plans, folks. These are unions, and they're generally union plans like if you're working for a carpenter's union, say. So you might work for one employer here, another employer there, another employer there. So all these employers, while the union workers are working for them, must pay into the pension plan. And then if the contract is done and the carpenters move on to another location, that company's not paying necessarily in anymore.
Yeah, it's kind of like a portable pension, which most people don't have access to.
So they call it a multi-employer plan. The protections on those are a little different. Don't confuse those with multiple employer plans. So a multi-employer plan is different than a multiple employer plan. Those are the new plans that were just expanded under the SECURE Act. And you're going to start seeing a lot more defined contribution plans under that type of structure.
And that's not going to cause any confusion, making a distinction between multi and multiple.
Right. It just, yes. We joked
There's
about
government.
That on the show.
Yeah,
so don't confuse that multi, but multi-employer plans are usually union plans. Now, Chris did point out that you could also have a union a private plan, but union employees who might be covered by the private plan. I often don't see that, though. Usually unions have their own pensions, and you need to find out if your union pension, is it a multi-employer plan that is covered by Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, or is it a union plan that might not be covered by the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation? In other words, your union is just covering the pension, and they get their pension payments directly from your paycheck, and it's going to the union plan, not a multi-pension plan. Gets very confusing, but the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation lays it all out on their website. Now, for those of you who aren't being dragged into this whole union mess, then you just have to make sure that your private pension is covered by the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. And pretty much the major exemptions to that are going to be private sector plans for small professional service companies. So keep in mind that a professional service is generally financial planning practices, doctor's offices, or other healthcare providers like chiropractors, optometrists, healing arts, as well as accountant firms, attorney firms, public engineers, architects, things of that nature. The Pension Benefit Guaranty Corporation has a whole list of these. If your company has had less than 25 active participants at any time since the passage of ERISA, and they are established and maintained by those professional service companies I just listed. Financial planners are one of them, by the way, Chris. So if Chris and I started a pension plan here at this firm, it would not be subject to Pension Benefit Guaranty Corporation protections or premium payments by us. Why? Number one, we're a professional services firm. And number two, we would have had less than 25 employees covered by that plan. So if you have an uber small plan from a professional services company, chances are you don't have Pension Benefit Guaranty Corporation. If you have church plans, you pretty much don't have Pension Benefit Guaranty Corporation protections. And some union plans, as we already said. So outside of those exemptions, folks, you can check the health of your pension plan. Other than that, your pension is pretty much covered. But ask your employer if you have any doubts. But then what you simply need to do is to stay informed about your pension plan by requesting every year they have to come out with an annual funding notice. Ask for it. They have to send it to you. They don't send it. I think they send you a notice that it's out. I guarantee you most people don't read it. But get that annual funding notice. The plan administrator is required every year to give that out. And that will include, among other things, the plan's funding percentage. In other words, they're going to say we're 80% funded, 85, 90, 95, 100, 110, 120. Those are great pensions. They're saying, hey, we got more money than liabilities. So they're going to give you the funding percentage. They're going to tell you how much assets are in the plan and the estimated liabilities against the plan. And it's going to tell you about their investments, how they've done, what their expected return is, what they've been returning. And that annual funding notice must give you a description of the Pension Benefit Guaranty Corporation and the protections offered under your plan. So pretty much everything you want to know, Chris, is in that annual funding notice. Yep. So these people who are worried, get that notice. Start reading it. Start paying attention to it. And then make an educated decision on if you feel comfortable with the pension risk or not. But if you have a large employer with a highly funded plan with a pension benefit at levels that are fully protected by the Pension Benefit Guaranty Corporation, I'd feel pretty comfortable, Chris, with that pension. Anything else you want to add?
No. I think sometimes one thing that you have to be aware of, even if the pension itself is good, sometimes the details or characteristics of the pension can be changed. So there is a risk not simply of it failing and going away, but of them stopping to do future adjustments or cost of living adjustments or some things like that in certain types of pensions. Not all.
Well, the courts have
restrictions on
that. However, do keep in mind, folks, don't get nervous with what Chris said. Your actual pension benefit payment is protected by ERISA.
Right.
They cannot go in and say, I know we told you we were going to give you 80% of your last 3 years' salary, but we don't want to anymore. We're going to give you 60% of your last 10 years' salary.
Right.
They cannot do that.
No.
What they are allowed to do, any employer, can change healthcare benefits, and cost of living increases to the pensions. Those two are on the table to be changed. Anybody in the state of Colorado knows this, who has the state of Colorado's pension, which is called PARA. PARA has been changing their COLA adjustments ever since I've moved to Colorado.
PARA is not an ERISA-protected plan,
it's not
plan,
an ERISA-protected
though,
plan, but the courts have ruled that that's okay.
Right. Yep. So just be aware of that.
And I don't think, if memory serves me correct, I don't know if PBGC gives COLA increases, but most private pensions don't. Anyways.
Correct. And I think you're right. I think even if, say, if you went from a pension that had COLA and then it fell back to the PBGC, I think COLAs stop.
COLAs stop. But very few
right.
private pensions
still
even
yeah.
offer a COLA anymore.
Right.
So COLAs are just the usually the realm of government pensions, and government pensions are allowed to cut their COLAs, and the courts have supported that. They can't cut your benefit. They can't say, oh, I'm paying you $50,000 a year, I'm going to start paying you $30,000. But they could say, hey, I'm paying you $50,000 a year with a 3% annual COLA. We're going to keep paying you $50,000 a year, but your COLA now is just 1%. They can do that.
Mm-hmm. Or zero.
But a private employer pretty much doesn't offer COLA.
Correct.
And I don't believe PBGC offers COLA.
Right. I don't think so either.
Okay. But anyways, get that annual funding notice. Read it. And make a wise decision. Don't make an emotional decision, especially with the way the stock market is right now. Don't convince yourself that we're all going to hell in a handbasket. And you're going to take the lump sum because you're worried the company's going to go out of business. Doesn't matter if the company goes out of business. What matters is the health of the pension plan and the amount of insurance protection that it has.
Yep.
Okay.
Perfect.
That was it.
So that counts as we did two before that and then three.
Three.
We're at five, technically.
Do you want to try to answer a Social Security question and get those off the list, or do you think this is enough?
That's totally up to you. We're getting a little long in the tooth as far as the length of the show, so maybe we should stop and do the
all right, we'll do it.
Social Security one first thing next time.
I think what we're going to have to do is another dedicated Social Security show because we've got a ton of Social Security questions.
Yeah.
So maybe, Bob's coming on next week to do some tax questions, so maybe the week after.
We'll do a Social Security one.
Social Security one.
Perfect. Sounds good.
Okay.
So thanks, everybody, for listening. If you're curious about our firm, jimhelps.com, we are still in the pause mode, but working to get out of the pausing of taking on new clients. So if you're interested in what we do for retirement planning, which is our niche, stay tuned. We will be able to take on new clients in the not too distant future is our hope. We're getting some additional resources so that we can handle those of you who want to come on board. If you want to send in a question to the Q&A show, as I said at the beginning of the show, best way to do that is go to jimhelps.com, the same place, to learn more about us. But there's a contact form on there that will send in the questions. The contact form will send the question to both Jim and I. If you email it directly to jim@jimhelps.com, a little better chance of making it past the junk filter because we've got a defective junk mail filter that sometimes filters out those contact forms. But the downside is it only goes to Jim. I don't get to see it. I guess it's a downside for me mostly because I don't get a preview of what the questions are going to be when we get to the shows. So, but we really appreciate everybody listening, and we'll be back next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
Investors should consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of investment company products carefully before investing. The prospectus contains this and other information about the investment company. Prospectuses may be obtained from your advisor and should be read in full. All guarantees are backed by the claims-paying ability of the issuing insurer. Withdrawals and death benefits are subject to income tax. If withdrawals and other distributions are received prior to age 59 and a half, a 10% penalty may apply. Shares, when redeemed, may be worth more or less than the original cost.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.